Welcome to Psych Gumbo, WTUL's mental health radio show for the New Orleans and Tulane community. I'm Dr. Holly Peek, and I am your host of Psych Gumbo. Now, today we have a very special guest with us. It is Dr. Omar Manijwala. His recently published book is called Craving, Why We Can't Seem to Get Enough. Dr. Manijwala is a psychiatrist and an internationally recognized expert on addiction and compulsive behavior. He is the former medical director of Hazelton, a treatment center in Minnesota, and currently is the chief medical officer of Catasys, a health management service company specializing in substance dependence. He has appeared on numerous national media programs, including 2020, CBS Evening News, and The Early Show. And now he is joining me here on the phone from Los Angeles. Thank you so much for joining us today on Psych Gumbo.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Holly.
And I just wanted to start off the program by telling you how much I thoroughly enjoyed your book. You know, you took a very complex topic such as cravings and addictions and linked all the science of it together in a very easily understood and concise book, and I really thoroughly enjoyed reading it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, so let's start off by saying, you know, what inspired you to write this book?
Right, so, you know, and I've been working with people who've been struggling with all sorts of cravings for many years, and most recently I was medical director of Hazelden, which is a big addiction treatment center, and over the years I've been working with people who've struggled with cravings, and I've always been amazed at how people struggle with cravings of all sorts, and then often try to use techniques to manage their cravings that maybe make their cravings worse. And there's this huge gap because there's research which I lay out in the book about, you know, where cravings come from and what causes cravings and how cravings can be effectively managed. And then there's what people actually do to deal with their cravings. And there's a gap between those. And I saw so many heartbreaking cases of folks who struggled with cravings over and over again of various kinds, food, alcohol, drugs, sex, and they weren't able to really pull together effective recommendations because the information was scattered or no one had really connected the dots. So what I wanted to do was write a book that really explained in plain, that digested the whole volume of research on cravings and digested them down into plain English so that a person who was struggling with cravings could read a book, you know, in an afternoon or an evening or over a few days and walk away with a sense of, okay, now I understand why I crave and what really works to manage cravings. So that's and I wrote the book really because it had to be written. Nobody else had written a book connecting these ideas together in this way.
Right. And the interesting thing to me about cravings are it seems very broad. You know, people can suffer from cravings for chocolate. That seems, you know, really painful and hard for them. But, you know, people also suffer from cravings for serious drug addictions and alcohol addictions. So what is your definition of cravings? And what is the link between cravings and addictions?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first of all, you know, there's no accepted definition of craving. So in the book, I put forth a working definition, which is basically, you know, craving is a strong desire that if it doesn't get fulfilled, it produces a very powerful physical and mental suffering. So that's a good working definition. And another definition of cravings that may be helpful to your listeners, Holly, is that, you know, a craving is an experience that is so intense that you can't think of anything else besides the thing you're craving. Mm-hmm. And that second definition was actually how craving landed in the psychiatric manual of disorders, this latest version, DSM-5. For the first time, craving is now a symptom of addiction. And and you're exactly right. You know, cravings are present in addiction, and they're also present when people don't have addictions. It's a huge problem. Right. 20 million Americans have some form of substance use disorder, not counting nicotine or tobacco or caffeine. And then on top of that, you got 500,000 people every year dying from tobacco-related diseases. And then you mentioned chocolate. You know, in obesity rates have tripled for adults in the last 30 years, and now you have a third of people who are obese in America, a third of people who are also overweight, so two-thirds of people are outside their weight range. And you know, if you think about that, that has to do really do with cravings. And so cravings are, you asked about sort of cravings and addiction. You know,
right.
A craving is an experience. It's a feeling. It's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Addiction is a disorder. So that can be characterized by experiences, but also by behaviors. So cravings are a component of addiction, and often a very heartbreaking component, because we know the research tells us that people who crave are more likely to relapse. But cravings are also present in non-addictive conditions, like, for example, obesity. I mean, think back to the last time you went on a diet, if you ever did, and why
yeah.
you went off that diet. Often it's cravings, right?
Right.
So it's very relevant, yeah.
Right. And, you know, something else you do a very good job in the book is you take a very complicated subject such as the brain and brain structure and its relation to cravings, and you break down the biological processes that drive cravings. I know it's a pretty in-depth topic, and we have a limited amount of time, but can you explain to the listeners how you break this down in the book, the biological processes that are behind cravings?
Sure. And so I think the most important thing that's needed when you explain brain science is to really put it into plain English so that people can see, okay, well, what's really going on in the brain when I experience a craving
mm-hmm.
and when I don't experience a craving? What's the difference there? And so in the book, I talk about the different functions of your brain. For example, learning, memory, conditioning, habits, your
mm-hmm.
ability to inhibit impulses, decision-making. Things that are so important for craving, like delayed gratification.
Right.
And then, you know, mood and stress, which are both very tightly linked to cravings. And those different functions in the brain, they don't rest in specific parts of the brain always, but often they derive from the connections between parts of brain. So they're almost the circuits. If you think about your brain is less like a hard drive, and your brain is more like a processor.
Mm-hmm.
And so your brain is really designed to categorize rather than memorize. And your brain is designed for efficiency rather than accuracy. So what happens is when you crave, essentially your brain is doing what it knows how to do, but then it makes errors. And those errors result in cravings. And so what I try to do in the book with the brain science is explain in simple language, well, how exactly that happens.
Right. Right. And you also talk about something called the plasticity of the brain and how our brain can change according to our thoughts, our actions, and experiences. So can you explain, you know, what plasticity of the brain is and how it affects us for the better and for the worse?
So there's this notion that people sometimes have that you're born with the brain you're born with and it can't really change. You may be able to change certain things, but in the end, your brain is pretty fixed. It's
mm-hmm.
it's pretty rigid. And it turns out that that's really not true. And there's all sorts of research now that shows that you can change your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that those changes that you make in your brain, from what you think, from what you do, from your experiences, even imagination can change the physical properties of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, when we talk about plasticity, we're really talking about that the brain can change, not just the chemicals, not just that you can have more neurotransmitters in one area or less, but that the actual physical properties of the brain can change. And just to give you a quick example, you know, there's an experiment that I cite in the brain, some research that I cite in the brain about people who practice a piano riff. And
mm-hmm.
when they practice that piano riff, the part of their brain that's responsible for their fingers grows. The actual
mm-hmm.
physical matter changes in their brain. And then they repeat the experiment, but instead of having people practice the piano, they just have them imagine practicing the piano. Don't even move your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And even when those people imagined playing the piano, playing a certain riff with five fingers, their brain properties changed, and the part of their brain real estate, if you will, that was allocated to their fingers grew. And so I use that in the book to explain how you can change your thoughts, your actions, your behaviors. You can even imagine things in certain ways that can result not just in temporary, but but in real persistent changes in your brain for the better. Mm. And that can help you manage cravings.
Yeah, and that seems like that would be a good strategy in breaking the cycle of behavior that cravings and addiction seem to become. Something else you talk about are the difference between chemical addiction and behavioral addiction, which I personally found pretty interesting. So what are the similarities and differences in these types of cravings that you describe?
Well, you know, it's funny because, and I know we were both at the American Psychiatric Association meeting in San Francisco this past year, and there's been a big hubbub about the fact that gambling addiction is finally, you know, sort of accepted as an addiction now.
Uh-huh.
And I think we're late to the game on that, since Gamblers Anonymous has been around for, you know, whatever, 50 or more years, I think. And so I think as psychiatrists, sometimes we're a little slow to the table in identifying compulsive behaviors. It's nice to see binge eating in there, but but certainly behavioral addictions, even if they're not directly recognized as such in our textbook, but this kind of compulsive behaviors people have with compulsive exercise and sexual activity, even internet compulsivity, we're seeing a lot of these days, not just with video games and massive multiplayer online role-playing games, but all sorts of compulsions when it comes to the internet. And exercise compulsivity is very, very serious. And so it turns out, and you know, I guess the easiest way for your listeners to think about this is that addictions are much more alike than they are different.
Mm-hmm.
Cravings are actually much more alike than they are different. And that's one of the deep, I think, discoveries that I came to when I wrote this book and interviewed the researchers who had conducted the research. And that is that the strategies that work for very severe addictions, you know, cocaine addiction, methamphetamine addiction, those same strategies can, with limited adjustment, but at their core, those same approaches to managing severe addictions can work for your addiction to food or chocolate cake or exercise or your cravings for all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
That these things really are much more similar than they are different, and that's good news because it means that the research we have for helping those severe addictions can also work on cravings of all sorts.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Something else you describe in your book, there's a chapter on the naive perception of immunity, which I had to laugh at as I was looking back on it today because, you know, I am a sweets fiend, a little self-disclosure here for my listeners. You know, I have the hardest time avoiding sweets, and I crave it. I truly do. And I'll go weeks without having it, but then I'll have this moment where I'll talk myself into buying this gallon of ice cream and saying, you know what, I'm going to make this last a week. I can do this. I'll only have a bite at a time. And before I know it, it's gone in 2 days or a day, embarrassingly, you know? It's this perception of immunity that people think that their own willpower can overcome it. They don't think they have a problem. Can you explain this trap? How do you get out of this trap?
Well, you know, and I'll admit I'm the same way. So it's a tough one. And I think a lot of us – and by the way, you know, the research does show that dieting increases cravings. And there's really solid kind of peer-reviewed research on that. So I try to really expose in the book how what people are doing can make things worse because, like – just like with the chocolate or the ice cream craving that you described, cravings are best managed not as a 911 call, what do I do now, I'm craving now, but rather as prevention and changing our behavior so that we're not setting ourselves up. And the naive perception of immunity is one area where we do set ourselves up. In other words, a lot of times we'll be successful and you know, so go on a diet, you lose 30 pounds, you stayed off ice cream for some period of time, and then you tell yourself, well, okay, I'm fine now. And that the little trap that your brain uses, and there's a variety of them in the book. I talk about them. They're cognitive distortions.
Mm.
They're parts of your brain that are designed for efficiency. They're designed to help you, and they do help you in many, many circumstances. But in a lot of circumstances, they trick you. They lie to you. Your brain lies to you, and it tells you this time will be different. I can always exercise this off. I deserve it. You know, I saw an ad for a particular brand of chocolate that was targeted towards women, and it basically said, you deserve this. And, you know, it's amazing because when I work with the people I work with, I tell them, here's the secret. It's not chocolate that you deserve. You deserve self-love. You deserve freedom from shame.
Mm-hmm.
You deserve authenticity. I mean, all the things that really you deserve, they're all missing from the ads. Instead, what you deserve is chocolate, right? So I think there's a lot going on there, but feeling immune to cravings, it can be a real setup for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we are about to run out of time here, but as some parting words, you know, living down here in New Orleans, I know you're out in Los Angeles right now, but a part of the culture in New Orleans, you feel like you're surrounded by so many vices. We have great food. We're surrounded by festivals and parties that equals alcohol, which makes the city fun and amazing. But at the same time, for people dealing with cravings or more serious addictions, how do you avoid it when you're surrounded by it? Like, how do you live with it? What's
and
your
then sometimes
tips
you can't, well, great question. Sometimes you can't, and there are people who actually leave sometimes to get recovery. This is true for gambling addicts in Vegas, et cetera, but not everybody needs to leave. I mean, I think if you're going to be surrounded, if you can't avoid exposure, first of all, you should try to avoid exposure. But if you can't, then really, you know, focus on the power of the group. Connect with like-minded people who are also trying to recover and learn what strategies they use. Mm-hmm. Focus on developing healthy habits and routines so that the habits can be hardwired and in place for when the craving does hit. Mm-hmm. I think creating a sense of belonging is another one. You know, if you can really find a place for your recovery from cravings in the midst of the chaos. I mean, some people take a degree of pride in the fact that, you know, they can stay thin and work in a bakery, or they can stay sober and work in a liquor store. I mean, we usually don't recommend that for alcoholic patients, but I've had several over the years who have successfully done it, and I think where they are successful is that they double up their efforts on everything else that they're doing, and that's really what it's about. So we do talk about people, places, and things. We do talk about environmental triggers, and in medicine we talk about cue-induced cravings, and they're very real. But, you know, stress is the primary driver of cravings, and really managing stress, meditating, using all the other recommendations to try and overwhelm, if you will, the effect of the cues that you're surrounded with is probably the best way to manage that environment that's filled with all sorts of goodies, like that delicious food you guys have down there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You know, unfortunately, this is all the time we have today. I feel like we could talk about this all day, and I'm going to recommend all my listeners to get your book, grab the copy, and read what you have to say, because it truly is fascinating.
Thanks, Holly.
All right, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have today for Psych Gumbo. Thank you again to our very special guest, Dr. Omar Manijwala. His book, Craving, is available on Amazon, iTunes, and your local bookstore. Check out my website at www.psychgumbo.com for more information on craving, and make sure to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Have a great day.